It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferrick.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Veronica Rickert. Coming up later in the program, we'll talk about a new survey showing increased support for toll roads in Wisconsin.
First, when it comes to great and maybe effective marketing campaigns, there may be no better examples than those created for diamonds. They're forever. Or a girl's best friend. With slogans like that and the images they conjure up, they practically sell themselves. But why does our culture put so much value in such a little stone in the first place?
Our next guest has written a book that looks at our culture's fascination with diamonds and says there's a lot we can learn about our experiences with these gems, about how we, as humans, create meaning, value, and identity in the world around us.
Joining us now is Susan Falls. She's a professor of anthropology at Savannah College of Art and Design, and she's the author of Clarity, Cut, and Culture, The Many Meanings of Diamonds. Susan, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, as an anthropologist, you delved deeply into the world of diamonds. You took a class, I think, on how they grade diamonds. Let's start with a basic. What is a diamond?
Well, a diamond is essentially a little package of carbon that has undergone a tremendous amount of heat and pressure and been transformed into, you know, what we see now as a diamond. There's a couple of other forms of carbon, like the graphite in a pencil, for example, is also pure carbon, and it's just really a matter of what's happened to it underground.
And we think of diamonds as a very scarce commodity, yet you point in your book, I think it's about 70% of American women own at least one diamond. Are they scarce or what?
Well, I guess it I guess it kind of depends on what you're talking about. On the one hand, as you cited, over 70% of American women own at least one diamond. Diamonds come in lots of different price points. There's, you know, expensive ones. There's less expensive ones. And the ones that are very, very large and of extremely high quality, those really are, you know, kind of scarce and quite rare. Smaller diamonds that perhaps would have a lower quality grade are, you know, much more common and can be purchased, you know, for a lot less. So they're, you know, more ubiquitous in our society as a result.
So as we mentioned in the setup there, you are partly writing about diamonds. You're partly writing about how we give meaning to stuff, to things.
Right.
How much of the meaning we assign to diamonds comes from the properties, whether it's uniqueness, the geological properties, whatever, of diamonds? How much of it comes from our brains and the way we talk about diamonds?
Well, this question really gets to the heart of the study, because on the one hand, we know that there's been a tremendously successful advertising campaign, one of the most successful in the annals of advertising history, that has promoted diamonds as these symbols of glamour, romance, love, status. And on the other hand, how do these meanings translate once people have them? This was one of the questions that I wanted to know. And, you know, diamonds do have a number of very special qualities, if you will. For example, they're excellent thermal conductors. They're very good for technological applications. Or the way that the carbon molecules line up, you know, is very regular and rigorous. And so it does have these special qualities. Now, the extent to which, you know, your average person might think about the, you know, physical qualities of a diamond in terms of generating a meaning out of them is, you know, varies tremendously.
Yeah, so, nobody says, darling, the thermal conductivity of this diamond symbolizes the flow of my love to you.
No, nobody, well, probably nobody
I hope.
Might say that. But they might say something about, if somebody, I don't know, knew a lot about, you know, chemistry or knew a lot about gems, they might make some kind of metaphorical connection between the strength of the valence electron connections and the power of their attraction for somebody.
Okay, I can see that.
As esoteric as that might sound, I did, you know, encounter many people that sort of knew, you know, I was actually quite astonished at the number of people who knew quite a bit about the material qualities of these stones.
And this is a big part of your research. You talk to people in the process of buying diamonds or who had diamonds. How did they talk about diamonds in engagement rings in particular? What What were they looking for? Why is the diamond so important as part of the engagement process?
Well, there's kind of several aspects to this question. One aspect of this question is, when was the engagement ring tradition started?
Yeah.
Right. So there's the history of diamond engagement rings that are, you know, up until very, very recently were quite particular to the United States. The diamond industry had attempted over the years to institute a similar tradition in other parts of the world, but have met with less success. Now, nowadays, in places like China or places like Japan, where there's a sort of, you know, westernizing dynamic in certain, you know, aspects of their society, people are beginning to take advantage of the possibility of diamonds as part of the engagement, you know, ritual. But at any rate, the diamond engagement ring sort of, you know, powers the diamond industry in the context of the United States. And many people, you know, there's this sort of narrative that, you know, one should spend 2 months' salary, or even sometimes people say 3 months' salary should be spent on the engagement ring, on the diamond that you're going to use in your proposal. And many people, you know, embrace this, or even extend, or, you know, spend even more than 3 months' salary. Other people feel like this is, you know, not useful way to deliver their resources, so that they spend less. Some women feel like if there's not a diamond ring that accompanies the proposal, it's not really a legitimate proposal. Hmm. There's a tremendous amount of variety about the way that people really feel about these things. But I think that part of the ritualized aspect of the engagement makes it sometimes difficult, I think, for people to make alternative plans. I think there's quite a bit of pressure for people to adhere to sort of traditional symbols.
Another running theme that comes up in your book is people who say, "Yeah, I'm not into diamonds. I don't like the whole status symbol thing." But this family heirloom I got from my aunt, my mom, my grandma. Well, that's different. It's got family meaning. Talk about how we build that heirloom meaning around a diamond.
Well, you know, I can't tell you how many people I talked with that, you know, had stories of receiving a diamond from a parent, an aunt, someone they loved, a, you know, family member, and they treasure these items and find them beautiful and alluring, but they're so, you know, saturated with emotional intensity that they may actually never wear them, but they would also never sell them or give them away. So they take on these kind of almost magical qualities.
Hmm. We're talking with Susan Falls about the role diamonds play in our culture and what that tells us about the ways in which we attach meaning and value to things. Her new book is Clarity, Cut, and Culture, The Many Meanings of Diamonds.
And you can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234.
We're talking with anthropologist Susan Falls about the many meanings of diamonds in our culture, and you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you have a diamond story, maybe an heirloom in your family? When it comes to wedding rings, engagement rings, it don't mean a thing if it ain't got that bling. Call in at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. Well, I want to get into an ad, Susan, that you analyzed. From the De Beers Company, boasted that a diamond is forever. Let's take a listen to a De Beers commercial from the 1990s that a lot of us remembered once we heard it again.
When you give a solitaire, you say more. And you say it with more brilliance, more depth, more fire. Diamond is forever. De Beers.
A diamond is forever. Can you talk about the impact that campaign had on us as consumers?
Well, I mean, the De Beers diamond marketing campaigns, of which there have, many, many, many decades, running with these same kinds of themes have really been astonishing. I mean, diamonds are, even though on the one hand, you know, a diamond is in some ways, maybe we might think of it really as a piece of gravel that's been polished and set into, you know, a beautiful ring. So, you know, how is its value established? On the other hand, you know, as you noted earlier, there are these tremendous cultural, economic, sentimental, and other kinds of values that we really celebrate, use, deploy in all kinds of different ways. And especially in the 1990s, especially the late 90s, when the financial markets were really booming, especially in New York, there was all these ads all over the place that were promoting big diamonds, you know, larger diamonds, and people were able to afford them. And so there was a way in which, you know, people were purchasing perhaps larger diamonds than maybe they otherwise would have.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Scott on the line in Door County. You can join in, by the way, at 800-642-1234. Scott, hi, you're on the air.
Hello, thank you. Yeah, I will preface this by saying I am somewhat down on diamonds, so I hope I don't come off as too much of a downer.
Not at all.
But there are reasons for it. I think it's a highly overinflated market, very artificial, and I think it really plays to a lot of things that we as Westerners should be examining ourselves about. It plays into our greed. Of course, it plays into romance, which, you know, that's easy to do. But I guess one of my gut reaction questions is, if it's such a rare commodity, why is it so readily available to everybody who's ever been married in Western culture, you know, for so many, many years? It's obviously not that rare. I think there's definitely issues with the way that they're mined, which have probably been addressed prior to my call. I just turned the radio on.
Scott, thanks for calling. And actually, we didn't get into that, and he is not a unique downer, Susan. Some of the people you talked to who own, maybe were even buying diamonds, that was a concern for some of them.
Most definitely. And especially, you know, in the late 90s and early 00s, you know, the people were much more aware of the violence that, you know, was attached to certain diamonds coming out of certain places in the world, and there was a tremendous amount of concern about blood diamonds, what is now called blood diamonds, both by, you know, consumers, by a number of NGOs, and also by the industry itself. So, you know, I just want to respond to, you know, parts of this is actually a great question that he's asked about the construction of value, and you're absolutely right that much of the value of diamonds is constructed. Now, having said that, this is also the case for, you know, lots and lots and lots of other kinds of commodities. So diamonds are not, you know, special in the sense that much of their value is constructed, nor are they special in the sense that the ways in which they are mined, produced, distributed, marketed is somewhat you know, smoky. It's hard to get information about it, and that's just part of the commodity fetish that I think, you know, characterizes the consumer society that we live in today. But your points are actually very well taken.
And we mentioned earlier the De Beers company. I think you asked one diamond trader how important De Beers was to the diamond industry, and the response is something like, "They are the diamond industry."
Right. He was very politic in his dealings with me, but he did sort of, you know, point out the importance of De Beers. And, you know, it is true that historically De Beers has, you know, really been the powerhouse behind the industry. They've been incredibly successful. Nowadays, because diamonds have been discovered in lots of places in the world that operate, you know, somewhat outside of the purview of De Beers, there's a lot more players in the industry today, and they're not as kind of, I don't know, hegemonic as they once were, but nevertheless, they're extremely important to the dealings of the industry.
Go back to our callers now. We've got Candace on the line in Madison. Candace, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Candace?
I wanted to ask about simulated diamonds and how those are possibly affecting what people are purchasing for engagement rings nowadays.
Okay. Well, let me just say, first of all, that there's an incredible book about the rise of synthetic stones by Robert Hazen called The Diamond Makers that I highly recommend if anyone is interested in this. there are both synthetic diamonds and also simulated diamonds that are on the market today. So, you know, simulated diamonds are things that look like a diamond, but they're not diamonds. So they might be glass, moissanite. There's, you know, several different products on the market that are relatively inexpensive. And then there's also the, you know, the synthetic market where diamonds are, you know, real diamond is actually made in a lab. And most of the lab-made stuff is used for industrial purposes. Some people feel like they prefer to have a simulated stone because they don't like some of the labor practices associated with the industry, or they feel like, you know, they, for various and sundry reasons, they may prefer to have a simulated stone. I think that for your average person, a good simulated stone looks, you know, pretty much identical to a, you know, a real diamond. Most people, when they look at a diamond or something that, you know, purports to be a diamond, they would have a very, very hard time telling whether or not it was actual a real diamond or not. And not only that, you know, what the sort of quality of that stone is.
When you're doing your anthropology and talking to people out shopping for diamonds, what did they make of it? Even if they couldn't visually tell the difference, if they knew, was it an important distinction to them?
Well, for some people it was. They said, you know, look, if I, you know, I love this beautiful stone. My husband gave it to me. My boyfriend gave it to me. My mother gave it to me. But if I discovered one day that it was, you know, glass or paste, I would be crushed. Other people were quite proud to wear a simulated stone and felt like it was beautiful. And that's really, you know, they were sort of in it for the aesthetics. People had very, very different ideas about the ways in which these things are interpreted, which, you know, in some ways, this is sort of what I was trying to discover was, you know, the extent to which the symbolic ideas that are attached to the diamond through the industry actually carry on into the life that these objects have with us. These kinds of objects and other kinds of commodities, too, because that's really when they become the most salient for us. We live ourselves into the world through material culture and our interpretations of it. So I was actually quite surprised at how varied and idiosyncratic people's ideas about these things were.
Well, looking at the world through the lens of diamonds and how we build meaning from them, what do you take from what you learned about diamonds and then apply out to other material culture in our daily lives?
Well, here's the thing, is that, you know, we're surrounded by material culture. Most of it is, especially in our society, is things that we've bought. They're commodities. They have sort of industry-sponsored symbolic meanings that are associated with them, whether we accept them or, you know, accept those meanings or not. And one of the things that I was, you know, sort of surprised and also very excited about was the fact that people were, you know, quite idiosyncratic. And we are, you know, people are very, very good at recognizing patterns in the world around us, but it's really the idiosyncrasies that make the world intelligible. And so I think that it's really important for us to kind of pay attention to the various way, the various creative sort of personal ways that people use material culture in ways that may or may not have been envisioned by, you know, people who are marketing these objects. So they almost become different kinds of objects once they get into our lives. And I think that's very interesting and exciting.
And you opened the book with your own diamond story, the friendship ring from your grandmother. What do you do with that now? Do you wear it? Do you keep it in a drawer in a safe deposit box? Where does that story lead to now?
Well, you know, it's funny. I was just talking with someone about this today, and it's a beautiful, you know, mine-cut diamond. And when I was doing this work, I had all kinds of, you know, some days I thought that diamonds were, you know, horrible and ridiculous, and then other days I became extremely you know, mystified them by them and saw them as these incredible, lovely, magical, truly extraordinary stones. And I had this ring, and I like to wear the ring when I'm going to be with my parents, or if I have a really special occasion, or if I'm somewhere where I sort of like to feel like my grandmother is with me, I will wear it. But it's too sort of, I don't know, it's almost as if it's too powerful for me to wear on an everyday basis. So most of the time it's in its little special box, velvet box, which I'm sure many people sort of might have a similar box like that, that they keep their special items that they don't pull out for everyday use.
Carries a lot of meaning. Susan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so very much for having me, Rob.
That's Susan Falls. She's an anthropologist. Her new book is Clarity, Cut, and Culture, The Many Meanings of Diamonds.
Coming up next, a political scientist joins us to discuss a new survey showing increased support for toll roads in Wisconsin.